the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Once again, a judge has struck, this time in California. The reports out of California indicate that San Francisco County Superior Court Judge Richard Kramer has ruled that the Golden State can no longer justify limiting marriage to a man and a woman. And if this case is not reversed on appeal, it looks like California will be the next state to have same-sex marriage. Now, just a little background to this. You will remember that last year, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom led an effort to issue same-sex marriage licenses. There were mass marriages and all the rest. And the city of San Francisco was ordered to cease and desist from that practice, but they then appealed, arguing that the law of the state of California banning same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. There was also a set of something like a dozen same-sex couples who joined in the suit trying to get the state's courts to reverse this ban that had been adopted by the people of California against same-sex marriage. And it looks like they got exactly what they were asking for. Now, we should note carefully that this is a decision by a San Francisco County Superior Court judge. Now, what that means is you can count on an appeal. This is not the California Supreme Court, not that I have any confidence there. And this is not the 9th U.S. District Court of Appeals, not that I have any confidence there. But this is not a high court decision that that is immediately to be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is a state court. But it is one more nail in the coffin of marriage, and it is one more graphic, irrefutable reminder of why we need a federal marriage amendment right now. Because those who are warning that we can wait to see what happens are failing to tell us what's going to have to happen before they're going to wake up. Because, in other words, we're going to wait for what? What has to happen before we recognize that a federal marriage amendment is necessary? If we do not act now, then the amendment will not be in place when we will need it, because a case like this is going to find its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and sooner than later. Because what you have out of the state of Massachusetts and out of the states, the states, 11 of which back in November adopted constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage, from those states there are appeals. Those appeals are going to find their way into the federal courts that will wind their way very quickly up to the Supreme Court, and we're going to have a ruling. And I just go back to the principle I have articulated so many times in this program. If we do not define marriage for the judges are going to define marriage for us, and we're not going to like what they come up with. And so write your congressman, write your senator, demand that there is action in the United States Congress immediately on a federal marriage amendment. We must have it. And if anything, we can at least thank today San Francisco County Superior Court Judge Richard Kramer for that reminder. By the way, you need to know something of the texture of his argument here. He said, quote, "It appears that no rational purpose exists for limiting marriage in the state to opposite sex partners." Now, that particular legal locution there, that legal phraseology, no rational purpose, is a fiction of this judge's mind and his subjective interpretation. What he's saying is, in his evaluation, there's no rational purpose. Obviously, the people of California had a rational purpose when they adopted this law banning same-sex marriage. So implicitly, this judge is saying that the people of California were irrational, and now he's going to bring rationality to find there's no rational purpose to limit marriage to a man and a woman in the state of California. He went on and he said, quote, "The state's protracted denial of equal protection cannot be justified simply because such constitutional violation has become traditional." San Francisco County Attorney Dennis Herrera, we heard much from him last year. He said today's ruling is an important step toward a more fair and just California that rejects discrimination and affirms family values for all California families. Lawyers with the Alliance Defense Fund said that they would appeal this judge's ruling, and I'm sure they will. The ADF is a very fine group of Christian attorneys who defend marriage, and they're going to be right on top of this one. We also need to note that in California, there are at least two bills before the California legislature that are moving towards putting the question of an amendment to California's Constitution on the ballot, an amendment that would ban same-sex marriage, limit marriage to the union of a man and a woman, and that's good news. So if you're in California listening to me right now, you need to get to your assembly member and make certain that they know your convictions on this issue and that they bravely, courageously, necessarily, urgently, and quickly get that question before the people of California so you can amend your Constitution before your Supreme Court gets this, because it will eventually get there pretty quickly on appeal. Well, so much for same-sex marriage, but not so much for judges. We're going to be talking about judges for the course of the program today, because when we come back in the second segment, we're going to be looking at the United States Supreme Court's rejection of the juvenile death penalty. That is, of the death penalty in the case of juvenile murderers. We're looking at the case of Christopher Simmons from Missouri, who committed one of the most brutal murders that the human imagination is capable of conceiving, and was given the death penalty by a jury in that state of Missouri, only to have the U.S. Supreme Court rule on March the 1st that the death penalty for juveniles is, well, you can guess this, cruel and unusual punishment. It violates evolving standards of decency and is thus unconstitutional. Now, I'm sure that's not news to you. No doubt if you've been listening to the news at all, you are aware that the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty for juveniles is completely now forbidden, unconstitutional. But we're going to be looking at the actual argument that was presented by Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy in his majority opinion, and we're going to be reminded once again that not only is the end result of a decision the immediate impact on the law, but it is the set of precedents that the court then adopts that give an indication about the future direction of its decision-making. And if this decision is any indication of the future direction of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision-making, we are in big trouble. More about that coming up in the second segment. First of all, on the question of abortion, one of the most interesting statements made lately was made by U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And before I tell you about it, I want you to hear it.
You told the Washington Times on Friday you were mildly pro-choice. What does that mean?
It means that, like many Americans, I find the issue of abortion very difficult. I believe it ought to be as rare as possible. Nobody wants to see anyone go through that. I favor parental notification. I favor a ban on late-term abortion. But I myself am not a fan of having the government intervene in the laws.
You would not outlaw it?
No.
Well, let me just say that on most issues, I'm a big fan of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. I've had the opportunity to meet her and to meet with her. I've had the incredible privilege of hearing her talk about her views of the international scene, of foreign policy, and she is a staunch defender of President Bush's policies around the world. But on this, she strikes out comprehensively, and frankly disappoints me beyond what I was prepared to admit in disappointment in her. When you actually hear what she has to say, it's worse than the reports about what she said. And not only that, what you heard was a clip from Sunday morning's program where she was interviewed by Tim Russert for Meet the Press. But she had been asked that question by Tim Russert because of an interview she had given on Friday to the Washington Times. She was asked, are you pro-life? Are you pro-choice? What is your thought on abortion? I want you to hear what she told the Washington Times. Quote, I believe if you go back to 2000, when I helped the president in this campaign, I said that I was, in effect, kind of libertarian on this issue. And meaning by that I have been concerned about a government role in this issue. I'm a strong proponent of parental choice, of parental notification. I'm a strong proponent of a ban on late-term abortion. These are things that I think unite people, and I think that's where we should be. I've called myself at times mildly pro-choice. She went on to say, yeah, mildly pro-choice. That's what it means. I think that there are a lot of things that we can unite around, and that's where I would tend to be. I'm very comfortable with the president's view that we have to respect, and we need a culture that respects life. But she went on and she said, I don't spend my entire life thinking about these things. You know, I spend my time really thinking about the foreign policy issues. But you know that I'm a deeply religious person. And so from my point of view, these extremely difficult moral questions where we're facing issues with technology and the prolongation of life and the fact that very, very young babies are able to survive now, very small babies are able to survive. These are great moral issues. What you have here is a Secretary of State wandering all over the map trying to find a position. But when she comes down to it, listen to this. What I do think is that we should not have the federal government in a position where it's forcing its views on one side or the other. End quote. Well, Madam Secretary of State, that is an illogical and gravely unfortunate position. Because the U.S. Supreme Court, the United States government, has taken a side on this. And the United States of America is one of only six nations in the entire world that offers and ensures abortion on demand. There is no such position as neutrality for the government in this question. It will either say that abortion is legal or illegal. There's no middle ground. There is no neutrality. And you know, when it comes to the war on terror, It seems that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is a very keen and discerning observer of what is good and what is evil. After all, she's given speeches in which she has spoken about the impossibility of moral neutrality. And she's right. I wish she would listen to herself in those speeches when she's considering her position on abortion. Madam Secretary of State, there is no moral neutrality on abortion. Strike out. I hope she'll do better next time. We'll be watching closely. We're going to come back to talk about Justice Anthony Kennedy, the United States Supreme Court, its rejection of the juvenile death penalty, and what it means. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, the United States Supreme Court handed down its decision on March 1 in the case Roper v. Simmons, and this is one of those cases we're going to remember for a long time. The oral arguments on this presented the case in very graphic terms. We've been waiting to see how the Supreme Court was going to rule, and I have to say, I'm really not surprised. I am disappointed, but I'm not surprised. Writing for the majority, you're not going to be surprised by this either, was Justice Anthony Kennedy. You know, it was just about last year, as I recall, that Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family identified Anthony Kennedy as the most dangerous man in America. And, you know, a lot of people wondered what he could mean by that. Well, just look at this case and you'll see what. Here is one man. Remember, he was the third and last justice appointed to the Supreme Court by President Ronald Reagan. Great things were expected of him. This is the man we got rather than Robert Bork. And, look what we got. We got a man who has moved to the left from the moment he began to sit on the nation's high court. We have a man who has demonstrated the worst forms of judicial activism, and in the case of the decision striking down the Texas sodomy law, in the case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, this is a man who wrote the majority opinion. And so not only did he vote with the majority, he actually ended up writing the majority opinion in this case in Roper v. Simmons. Let's just talk about what we have here. At age 17, just a few months shy of his 18th birthday, Christopher Simmons murdered a woman. He got together with two teenage friends and talked about murdering her, said he was going to murder her, and said that if they did it, they'd get away with it because they were minors. He then broke into her home, bound and gagged her, tied her up with duct tape, took her to the trestle on the Merrimack River, and threw her overboard. She drowned. Her body was found later by fishermen. Christopher Simmons went back to school and bragged about having murdered her. He said he was going to murder her, he was going to enjoy murdering her. He did murder her. He was arrested after all he'd been talking about the crime. Police in Fenton, Missouri traced the crime back to him, arrested him. Within just a few hours of his arrest, he was telling them everything. He waived his Miranda rights, was treated as an adult because he was outside the judicial criminal system, the juvenile system, and he then even participated in a videotape reenactment of the crime. At his trial, the jury in Missouri was presented with three different criteria that would have to be met for the imposition of the death penalty, and a jury of his peers in Fenton, Missouri, decided that in this murder, Christopher Simmons met all three of the criteria for the imposition of the death penalty. He had premeditated this crime. He had bragged about it. He seemed to enjoy it. He did it for money. He did it in order to cover up his misdeeds. He did it with all the aggravating circumstances required by Missouri law for the imposition of the death penalty. He was given the death penalty. He got new lawyers and appealed. He appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court, which ruled in his favor. The state of Missouri then appealed to the federal courts. It ended up before the Supreme Court, and thus the decision handed down on March 1. But I want you to know what Anthony Kennedy is up to in this decision. He says that this nation's, quote, evolving standards of decency, end quote, that's a phrase that has been used by the court now for years, mean that even though the juvenile death penalty was constitutional one time, it's unconstitutional now. Now, how recently was it constitutional? Anthony Kennedy was in the majority that found it constitutional in 1989. Now, just 16 years later, it's no longer constitutional. Anthony Kennedy decided he was going to play the part of a psychologist or a psychiatrist in writing the majority opinion. He argued that there are three general differences between juveniles under 18 and adults. The first one is that they lack maturity and have an underdeveloped sense of responsibility. The second is that they are more vulnerable or susceptible to negative influences and outside pressures, especially peer pressure. And the third is that the character of a juvenile is not as well formed as that of an adult. Well, you can agree or disagree with those assertions. Frankly, I think that most of us would agree with them. But I don't agree that that gives this court the right to invalidate the decision of the states to apply the death penalty in cases of egregious murder where a 17-year-old committed the crime. I reject the notion that a 17-year-old cannot be responsible for the crime and thus pay the penalty for committing capital murder. It's interesting that even in his majority opinion, Anthony Kennedy cites a psychologist like Eric Erickson in his book Identity, Youth, and Crisis. He cites it as if that should just stop the discussion. Well, of course, if Eric Erickson says that juveniles are immature and thus irresponsible, we have to take that as gospel truth. He even cites the American Psychiatric Association that has a rule that you can't diagnose any patient under 18 as having antisocial personality disorder. He says, well, if the psychiatrists don't even allow themselves to diagnose a patient under 18 as being afflicted with antisocial personality disorder, how can we put them to death as if they are culpable murderers? He says this, the differences between juvenile and adult offenders are too marked and well understood to risk allowing a youthful person to receive the death penalty despite insufficient culpability. Well, if you're not troubled enough already, know that the remainder of Justice Kennedy's argument is really aimed at international opinion and foreign law. He says that we have to bring our evolving standards of decency into alignment with the international courts, which have abolished the death penalty for juveniles. He says the United States of America is the only nation in the West in particular that still have a juvenile death penalty. Even states like China and Somalia and others, he says, have gotten rid of it. But, of course, he completely ignores the fact that their legal systems may outlaw the juvenile death penalty, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But furthermore, he cites Europe, Great Britain, and the rest of the international community. He cites the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, and he says we have to bring the United States into alignment with the rest of the world. Now, before I tell you what I think about that opinion, let me just tell you that Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor, rejected it, saying that she centered in her dissent on the fact that Justice Kennedy said that 17-year-olds can't be culpable for the crime of capital murder. She said, of course they can. And she said this. She said, instead, the court has now rested its judgment on the independent moral judgment that death is a disproportionately severe punishment for any 17-year-old offender. I do not, she said, subscribe to this judgment. But in order to measure the outrage of conservatives on the court, you have to look at the bombastic and eloquent dissent of Justice Antonin Scalia. This is a man who minces no words. He rejects, first of all, Anthony Kennedy's claim that a majority of Americans are a national consensus is against the juvenile death penalty. He points out that a majority of states that have the death penalty allow the execution of juveniles. And he points out that this court, says Scalia, is in no position to judge what a national consensus is. If there were a national consensus against the juvenile death penalty, the legislatures would have outlawed it. It would not be necessary for the Supreme Court to act. The very fact that the Supreme Court is now facing this case, argues Scalia, is an indication that there is no national consensus against it, and instead Justice Kennedy has decided, along with the majority of the court, to impose his own understanding of morality in the place of a national consensus. But when it comes to reasoning that involves the foreign courts, he simply levels his intellectual guns. And he says this, unless the court has added to its arsenal the power to join and ratify treaties on behalf of the United States, I cannot see how this evidence favors rather than refutes the position of the majority, referring there to the citation about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Scalia points out that the United States Senate ratified that only with the proviso that that did not mean that America could not execute juveniles for capital murder. Scalia is right, in fact. In his final conclusion, he says this is no way to run a legal system. But that's what we've got. Now, I have to tell you that I am not a big defender of the juvenile death penalty just as an issue in itself. But I'd be willing for the legislatures to decide that. Legislators elected and accountable to the people. But I reject the notion that a 17-year-old cannot be culpable for capital murder. And furthermore, I am outraged that a Supreme Court majority would cite foreign court precedents and international conventions in order to establish what is to be our national consensus. But I want to know what you think. The phone number, 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. My guess is that you're troubled about this as well, and this is the place to talk about it. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, folks. You know, when we talk about judicial activism, people often think that that's some kind of abstract issue, difficult to understand. Well, it's not difficult to understand. Here you see it in the face. The legislatures of the 50 states did not decide to outlaw the juvenile death penalty. Some states did, and that's fine. Other states did not. And a majority of states have the death penalty, have some provision that would allow a jury to apply the death penalty in a case in which you have a juvenile, especially a juvenile, it has to be 16 or 17 years old because of the previous court ruling, that may understand in aggravated cases to very much deserve the death penalty. But Justice Anthony Kennedy, as he has done in other cases, now just cites a new national consensus. But it's a matter of his wishful thinking and sociological analysis. He's putting himself in the position of legislators. Now, I'm going to tell you a couple of things that may surprise you. Number one, I believe in the death penalty. You know that from listening to me on this program. I believe in it because it is a biblical concept about the value of human life. But when it comes to the execution of juveniles, I'll have to tell you that I think this is a case in which we need to apply the strictest legal scrutiny. I think the jury needs to be incredibly well-versed. But if, indeed, the legislatures of all 50 states decided to outlaw the death penalty for juveniles, I would accept that as a national consensus. But I can't accept activism from a court, even the nation's high court, to take that power away from the legislators and thus away from the people. Now, I'm going to mention one other thing about the death penalty at large. Continually, in trying to outlaw abortion, to confront the culture of death, and to make very clear that abortion is the wanton taking of innocent human life, I'm confronted by people who say, well, you're inconsistent because you oppose abortion and euthanasia, but you're for the death penalty. Well, number one, that's not inconsistent. Because the Bible presents the death penalty not as a violation of the sanctity of human life, but as a necessity. Grounded to affirm the sanctity of human life. If you take an innocent human life, you forfeit your own. But you know what? I just want to tell you as a pragmatic matter, I'd make a deal right now to eliminate the death penalty if we could also eliminate abortion. I don't accept that that's a necessary issue to ensure consistency, but I'll tell you, right now, if I could save unborn babies, I'd be willing to make that deal. But that's not the kind of reasoned discourse we're having here. Instead, what we're talking about is the overreaching of the United States Supreme Court in the case of juveniles. And the problem, as Justice Scalia said, is there are no brakes on this. There are no limits. There are no boundaries. What's next? Let's go to Russ calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN.
Hey.
Glad to hear from you, Russ. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, at what point does the 17-year-old, who's maybe 364 days into his 17th year, become all those things that make him mature? I'm sure you and the other listeners know 40-year-olds who don't meet those criteria for maturity. And here you have a case where a person who's shy of his 18th birthday by weeks is bragging, is meeting all the criteria for the Missouri set for a heinous crime, and in this case, showed himself to be beyond reproach and took the stance that he was beyond
yeah.
the law.
Now, I understand your point, Russ. I mean, what's 24 hours before he turns 18? Well, it's everything to Justice Kennedy. He just drew a very clear line and said, 18 and over, there you have it. But as Justice Scalia says, well, then how soon is it until we have 18-year-olds who are said to be lacking in this kind of mental capacity? How long before it's human beings at large who are just ruled to be immature and unable to understand the consequences of their actions? Russ, this decision is arbitrary, and you're affirming that, and you're exactly right. Steve's calling from Minnesota, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Steve, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you. Enjoy the program a great deal. It really makes me think. I guess the question I just pose, I guess, is, I kind of see myself as a Christian first, a follower of Christ, and then a United States citizen. And the question, from the gospel of Jesus Christ, what he taught and stuff, I mean, how would he deal with this boy?
Well, what do you think he would do, Steve? You've got a point here. Go ahead and play it out.
Well, it's just... I mean, it's so clear in the in the scripture with Jesus' life and stuff. In terms of capital punishment in general, you know, I mean, I understand your views on and stuff like that, but it just doesn't coincide with what he taught whatsoever.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but Stephen, hang on. If you and your cell phone signal can last through this break, we'll come back to you in just a moment. There's still time for you out there to join this conversation. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The issue is the death penalty for juveniles. Was it right for the Supreme Court to simply rule that evolving standards of decency outlaw it and make it unconstitutional? 877-893-8255 is the number. The death penalty is the issue, and we'll be right back with your discussion. Justice Anthony Kennedy, in his majority opinion in the case of the juvenile death penalty, said that juries really shouldn't have the right to consider whether or not a juvenile age 16 or 17 would be mature enough to understand his decisions and take responsibility for his crime and thus receive the death penalty. He's also said the states don't have the right to put that law on the books that would allow the juvenile death penalty, and he cited what he called an evolving standard of decency. That's old language used by the court all the way back to the Earl Warren days. He cited the fact that it's cruel and unusual punishment. He cited that there's a new national consensus on the issue. And he cited the fact that there's an international consensus that appears to have been the deciding and driving factor in this in the first place. I want to know what you think about this. The phone number, 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. Just before we went into the break, we're on the phone with Steve calling from Minnesota, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Steve, let's pick up where we left off. I was asking you what you thought Jesus would do in the case of this boy who committed this kind of murder. And you were talking about what Jesus said and did, and I just want you to be specific and help us to understand here.
Well, if you read in Matthew and stuff like that, and the main thing is what he didn't do, I guess. And he always affirmed, look what they did to him. I mean, he laid down his life.
What would you do, Steve? Just tell me, citing Jesus as an example, and by the way, I think what you're looking for is John chapter 8. My thought was you're going to cite Jesus with a woman caught in adultery, and I'll deal with that. But first of all, you raised the question, what would Jesus do? What do you think Jesus would do?
Well, I don't think he would ask us to kill him. I don't see that anywhere in the scripture.
All right, Romans chapter 13 is the place to go. I just tell you that in the New Testament. Steve ran to move on to other calls, but it's clearly in the scripture. And Jesus nowhere outlawed the death penalty. In the case of the woman caught in adultery, he very clearly said he was without sin, cast the first stone, as he was confronting the Pharisees. But, the Bible is actually filled with a lot of information about the death penalty and the Old Testament for many crimes. But in the New Testament in particular, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 13 speaks about the government's use of the sword, which is the death penalty. And he affirms that. But, Steve, you raise a question. What would Jesus do in this situation? I think that's a difficult question to answer because we do not have Jesus on a jury. And we do not know from the Gospels what Jesus thought comprehensively about a justice system, but we do know that he said it must be just, and that means that the wrongdoer must be punished. Jesus never suggested otherwise. Let's go to Dan calling from Tampa, listening on WTBN.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Mueller. I just thought this was a very interesting thing, and I didn't, I've listened to you for a long time, and when you brought up, you really hit a nerve when you brought up, not a nerve, but a good nerve, but when you brought up the point that you would make the deal to get rid of abortion and the death penalty if they both make that deal. And I thought that was just one of the most caring things a person could say. When you talk about the things that you talk about, it really came through that you just really care about, people and what happens in this world. And I think that most people have gotten away from what I call timeless principles that began with the beginning of time with God's word, that we've gotten so far away from trying to do things ourselves. We spend billions of dollars in our school systems to teach our children that we come from protoplasm and just slime and we just evolved into something and we can kind of do whatever we want, and then we spend billions of dollars trying to rehabilitate them and tell them that they're not these people and they're supposed to be this way. And it's always a back and forth instead of just starting from the very beginning and teaching that, hey, these are the things that, are set upon us to protect us and keep us safe and what I call timeless principles. I mean, they go back from the beginning of time,
Yeah, Dan, hold on just a minute here. When you speak about those timeless principles and you speak about the sanctity of life, are you thinking about, for instance, what God said to Noah in Genesis chapter 9 when he affirmed the sanctity of human life, when he said, whoever sheds a man's blood by man's hand, his blood shall be shed? For in the image of God, he made man. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, I'm right with you.
Reading through that whole thing all the way into Exodus when he was up in the mountains and stuff, and he came down and they were just sinning and bowing down to, you know, false gods and stuff, and they shed blood for that, you know what I mean, for those sins and turning away from God and being evil, you know. I mean, it is an evil. I mean, this child actually did what he said he did and was proud of it and, you know, explained it all. I mean, he knew what he was doing, 17 or not. He knew what he was doing.
Dan, I agree with you on that, and I believe this young man was fully responsible, and so did a jury. That's the important issue here. So did a jury, presented with the evidence, presented with the defendant sitting there before them in court. And this jury had to find three different particular aggravating factors to apply before they could impose the death penalty, and they did. Thanks for your call, Dan. Calling from Palm Harbor, Florida, is Ricky, listening on WTBN. Ricky, go right ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question concerning, is the court becoming the village that Mrs. Clinton always talked about, where they're raising our children, they're taking the decision out of the hands of the family, out of the community, and they're deciding what's good for us. And
yeah. Well, as a general direction, Ricky, I think the answer to that is lamentably yes. That's why we have to be extremely vigilant in terms of this court. And, you know, all you have to do is look across the northern border to Canada, where there are big issues like parents' right to discipline children being under court review. The Supreme Court there, the High Court considering that. Also, the legislature there considering banning it. Yes, we have the rise of the nanny state, Ricky. What we have is government taking on more and more authority, entering into more and more domains where it had never been before and where it was never intended to be, and the family is one of them. I don't think that is the particular issue in this case, although it is a haunting reminder that the same logic found in this case could be employed somewhere else, including in the domestic sphere of the family. Folks, this is a truly frightening decision. Justice Scalia is exactly right in his dissent. And, you know, as you look at the particulars of this case, it just reminds you that reality is a tough concept. But the reality is, here you had a 17-year-old boy who committed capital murder, who plotted it, planned it, entered into a conspiracy to do it, did it, bragged about it, said he was going to get off because he was a minor, and then celebrated the next day and bragged about having done it. And you know what? The strangest thing is, Christopher Simmons was right. He did get away with it. Because he will not face the death penalty. He will not face the justice of the state of Missouri in terms of the death penalty and execution. He was right about that. He did get away with it. And now his name will be forever linked in this case to the judicial activism of Justice Kennedy and four colleagues on the United States Supreme Court who ruled that they will determine what are the evolving standards of decency, and they will determine what is a national consensus on the issue, and if one does not exist, they'll just claim it anyway. And if that's not enough, they'll go to international courts. As Justice Scalia said, they don't want to go to international courts for precedents on jury trials. They don't want to go to international courts on issues of, for instance, abortion rights, or even issues of church and state. But when it comes to something like the death penalty, they go shopping for foreign opinions. When I come back, I'm going to talk about just that issue. I'll be back with the final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, Anthony Kennedy and a majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices decided that the death penalty is out for juveniles age 16 and 17. Now, they jumped to that new evolving standard of decency and that newly discovered national consensus that appears to exist only in their own minds. And all this since 1989 when the court ruled last on the issue. Of course, we've been looking at this as an example of the kind of judicial overreach, the imposition of judicial activism in the place of the legislatures. Folks, if a national consensus actually existed, the legislatures of all 50 states would have outlawed the juvenile death penalty. But they didn't. This isn't a national consensus. Just think about the 1973 decision Roe v. Wade, where the United States Supreme Court ruled that abortion on demand must be fully legal. There was no consensus on that issue. And ladies and gentlemen, there is still no consensus on that issue. That doesn't seem to bother the Supreme Court. It certainly doesn't seem to bother Anthony Kennedy, who in 1992, in the case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood, affirmed the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. He wasn't worried about evolving standards of decency then. He wasn't worried about a national consensus on abortion then. This is judicial activism wearing black robes. It is a coup d'etat of sorts in our government, and it underlines why the nomination of judges and the confirmation of judges by the U.S. Senate is such a non-negotiable and important issue. If we're going to stop the process of our courts and judges looking to international courts and foreign law for precedent, then we better get the right courts in shape. We better get the right judges on the courts, the right jurists, the right justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that means that the United States Senate is going to have to get serious. And Senate Majority Leader Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee is going to have to provide leadership to make certain that President Bush's nominations to the court will not be filibustered. We'll be watching that very carefully. You know, the issue of judges gets down to the fact that if we do not correct this pattern of judicial activism, then as Justice Scalia warned, there is no boundary on where this might go. The death penalty today, abortion yesterday, maybe euthanasia tomorrow, maybe same-sex marriage even closer on the horizon. Given the fact that the courts have taken on this role within our governmental system, we had better put some limitations on it, and the only way to do that is by putting the right people on these courts and by instructing the courts regarding the law. That's why the Federal Marriage Amendment is so important, and that's why we've got to get it passed. We'll be following this closely for you, folks. Well, happy Pi Day to you. 314, that's the number Pi, and in schools and museums and offices all over America, it's Happy Pi Day. There are even greeting cards for Pi. In case you don't know, Pi is the numerical constant that represents the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter on a flat plane surface. Now you know. Pi r squared, that's the formula. Go home and wish your loved ones a happy Pi Day, and then have a piece of pie. I'll meet you tomorrow for the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.